Oh, my name is Utah and I am an alcoholic. Oh. Sober by the grace of a loving God since February 23rd, 1990, and any success I have is far more his success than mine. And I say that to remind me that I do not deserve what I've got today, the sobriety that I have. It's just truly a gift of joy. I would first of all like to thank the committee and Milton for the loving invitation to be here this weekend. When I was sitting there, I was reminded of when Renee read How It Works, and you have it on your little program. You've got, but there is one who has all power. That one is God, may you find him now. And what a wonderful opportunity in this environment to practice the presence of a power greater than ourselves. I mean, just it is wonderful, and the joy that we get to experience in the fellowship and the camaraderie and the, let's say, colorful imagination. So thank you. My home group is the Three Legacies group in Huntsville, Alabama. We meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7 o'clock, closed discussion meeting. And if you're ever in Huntsville on those nights, please come and see us. For the Al-Anons, if you come the last Tuesday of the month, we have our open speaker meeting. So, and we celebrate AA's anniversaries at that time. I have a sponsor. Her name is Gay G from Georgia, and she has a sponsor, and I am privileged and honored to sponsor women and a few men in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I believe we talked about this last night at a meeting, and it is the book describes it as the foundation, one of the foundation stones of Alcoholics Anonymous is being able to work with others. And it's that intensive work that I believe keeps me in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came here as described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, selfish and self-centered to the extreme. When I got here, and thank God for the shift in perception, the psychic change that occurs once we get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and start taking the steps and are afforded that psychic change. My name is Utah, and it's you see on my badge and on the program, it's UTAH. Which is kind of unique in itself, but you really spell it J-U-T-T-A. It looks like Jutta, it's German, and in Germany it's real common, and here it is not. growing up, it was interesting. I was born in Germany, so I am alien. I wondered why I always felt different, you know, now I know. But I was born in Germany and came to the United States when I was 3 and adopted by an American military man and was raised in the military. And for some reason, it was interesting. I went to like 10 different schools in 12 years, and I would always have to get in front of the class and say my name, and for some reason y'all laughed, and I didn't know why, you know, but I felt very insecure at who I was, and I didn't like who I was, and I didn't like where I was, and I didn't like doing what I was doing or who I was doing it with. That was from the get-go. Always wanted to be somewhere else, and thank God for the military because it took me to all those little geographical cures that I found out that's what you call them, and it still didn't work. On reflection, I realized that there was a void in my life. There was something missing, and I heard someone share this, and it worked for me. It fit. It was there was a God-shaped hole in my soul, and I used whatever I could to fill that. I used everything outside of me to fill that which was missing within me. There was alcohol in my home. Dad drank beer, Mom drank wine, and I don't know whether there was if they had a problem with that, I don't know. I do know that I have two brothers. One is 2 years younger than I am, and he is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and has 11 years of continuous sobriety. So that's me hearing about this being a family illness, it kind of related in that part of my life. And my other brother is 6 years younger than I am, and he, for some reason, he drank the way I drank, and he felt the way I felt, and did a lot of the things that I did. And 6 years ago, he quit drinking, and I didn't understand that, because how do you just quit drinking? How do you do that? You know, just stop. And he said, "Utah, well, the doctor said if I don't stop, I'm going to die before my time." And I realized the big book describes him as a hard drinker. Given a sufficient reason, the hard drinker can stop drinking. Given a sufficient reason, I could not stop. Therefore, I know today that I am a real alcoholic. And it takes for me, Alcoholics Anonymous, and God, as I understand God, for me to have sobriety of any worth, you know, a worthwhile sobriety. There was a lot of love in our home. And again, this is on reflection. I was incapable of receiving that love. It was not enough. It wasn't the right kind. I always want more of everything. And then more is not enough. I learned at an early age how to lie. I don't know why. I learned how to cheat, and I learned how to steal. Now, that was not something that happened in our home. That was just something, it was a natural thing for me to do, because I want you to like me, so I'm going to lie to you about me, or I'm going to lie to you about you, so you will like me. I always wanted things that I wasn't able to have, so if I couldn't have them, I would steal them, or I would steal money out of my mom's purse to get what I wanted. And cheating came very natural, because I am not an A student for some reason, and Mom wanted me to be an A student, and I wasn't. So if I cheat, then I get to be an A student. So that was how I grew up before even drinking. Look at this. Oh. Johanna's got some even smaller ones up here. I didn't know what to do with those. So that was pretty much, I grew up moving a lot and not liking anything about myself or where I was, and that was all there was to it. Dad, being in the military, did 3 tours of duty in Vietnam, and every time he went to where we couldn't go with him, home base was Loosedale, Mississippi. A dry county, the other side of Mobile, Alabama, if you're not familiar with Loosedale. And it was interesting. Dad had gone to Vietnam. I was 16, I was in the 11th grade, and I had my first date. And my date picked me up and took me to a drive-in movie, because that's what they had. And he had slow gin. Now, I remember this. I remember my first uncontrolled, unsupervised drink, because he had the slow gin, and I don't remember if he mixed it, and this is before styrofoam, but he fixed a drink with whatever, and I remember taking that drink, and you know, it was not a big deal. I remembered it was sticky and it was sweet, and I have big teeth, so I thought it was probably sticking to my teeth. But you know, nothing happened. And it was that second drink that, for me, the magic of the booze happened. And what happened was, I hear what happened to me at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. For some reason, when I took that second drink, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. I didn't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. For some reason, I comprehended the word serenity and I knew peace. I liked, for the first time in 16 years, who I was, where I was, doing what I was doing, and who I was doing it with. And I continued to drink, and the last thing I remember, I did get drunk, but the last thing I remember was the windows of the vehicle were fogging up, and I have no idea what the movie was. So this is now hearsay, but my date took me home, and the next day, the miracle of this first drunk was I suffered no consequences. I didn't have a hangover. I didn't feel bad. My mom didn't ground me, because mom was very, very strict with me. She was really strict with me, but I got into no trouble. So, you know, I thought, if this is what alcohol does, then I'm going to do this as often as I can. Living in a dry county in Mississippi in 16, I couldn't do it every day, but I just did it as often as I could, and I did not set out to get drunk every time I drank. The Big Book describes my drinking career as a progressive and a fatal illness, and that's what I have, and it was so very progressive and subtle, and I never knew that I never knew I was going to be an alcoholic. I never knew that. It was interesting. I didn't know I was going to be allergic to penicillin either, but it kind of snuck up on me. Graduated in 1969 from Ozark, Alabama, and Dad went to Vietnam again, so I'm back in Lucedale, and I'm supposed to go to college. So I knew that my mom wanted to be a nurse, and she couldn't be a nurse because I was conceived out of wedlock. So I'm going, the people pleaser that I am, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to be a nurse to fulfill her dreams. And I go to nursing school in Mobile and Spring Hill College, and my college career is very short-lived. The one thing I did get to learn, though, I learned about fraternity parties. And I learned about kegs of beer and lots of fun and guys, you know, all of this stuff. And I loved that aspect of college. I did not like the nursing part, because I am not caring and I am not compassionate, you know, like, if you are sick, help yourself, you know. So that part was not fun, and then the academic part was even less fun, and because I'm busy doing the partying, so how can I be doing all this other stuff too? And I was asked to write a paper, and it was the English instructor said that the assignment was to write a poem. And I was busy, so I didn't write one, but I copied one. And it was one that I'd never heard and I'd never read. So I figured, well, I can do this. And I turned it in, and my next class that I showed up at, I got the paper back and it had F. Now, F did not bother me, because I had, from experience, learned how to make A's out of F's. But what bothered me about that paper was underneath the F, the instructor had written plagiarism. Now, I had to look that word up. I did not know, I had no idea what that word meant, so I looked it up and I went, oh my gosh, he knows that I didn't write this. And so that means I cannot show up for class anymore because he knows. He knows who I am. And I didn't show up for class anymore, but I did show up for those fraternity parties, and I drank and I partied and had a wonderful time. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous shares with us how the harm that we do to others, and it's we can do physical harm, mental harm, emotional harm, and spiritual harm. And I caused my mom a lot of harm because for a whole year I didn't let her know where I was. I'd met a guy 6 years older than me, and I commenced to move in with him and never let mom know that I wasn't still in school, and I was just partying, and I finally got a job. I quit partying at the fraternity parties, though, because the guy that I moved in with introduced me to the bars. And I loved the bars. I loved, and you could be 18 and drink in Alabama at this time. So I was able to go to the bars and be an adult, which I, when you're 18 going on 35, you know, and drink and party and dance and live bands and smoky rooms, and I loved it. I loved the bars. Now, I was in this relationship for 2 years and partied a lot, but I also, and the book just says, we are hard workers. You know, we work hard, and I know I do. Work hard and party hard. So I got a job. My first job was a long-distance operator, and this is before computers, so it was like putting the little plugs in the wall, you know, and it was great. And it was shift work, and that was good. Or working 3 to 11, you know, and then when you get off of work, God, you get to party. So that was good, and that lasted for 2 years. And after 2 years, I had gotten the RIDS. The Big Book describes the RIDS for me as restless, irritable, discontented. Something's got to change, you know, in my life. So I got out of the relationship, and what I did was I didn't go to the bars by myself, but I just kind of continued to work and then partied at home. I drank at home. Not to get drunk, but just to know that new freedom and that new happiness and not regretting the past. And it was just, it was wonderful. Those promises were just wonderful. And I continued to show up for work. Now I'm living in Mobile and I am invited to a party. I'm invited to an Auburn, Alabama party in Gulf Shores. Now, I knew I lived in the state of Alabama. I had no idea what Auburn was. I thought it was a hair color. And I knew what party was. So I go to Gulf Shores for this Auburn, Alabama party, and I had an awakening. And it had to do with football. It had to do with the Iron Bowl, and where Auburn and Alabama, and I'm sure Tennessee and maybe Vanderbilt or whoever. I don't know who your rivals are. I don't, but anyway, it was a rivalry. It was a wonderful party. But what happened at that party was I met the man of my dreams. There was a lot of booze there. There were a lot of people there. And it was like, oh my gosh, here I am and there he is. And that's what I've got to have. I went back home after that party, and I made it an assignment to get a date with this man that I met. And it took a couple of months to get that, but I did. I finally got finagled a date, a blind date, and he came to Mobile and picked me up. He was blind, I was not. And we went, he took me back to Gulf Shores, and he introduced me to another level of my drinking. He introduced me to the beach and the sun and the full moon and the Gulf of Mexico. He introduced me to Pink Pony Pub in Floribama and Gulf Gate Lodge. He introduced me to skinny dipping in the Gulf and all the booze we could drink. We spent our whole paychecks at these establishments, and it was wonderful. I love the beach. I love the Gulf. I love being half naked or half, you know, dressed. I love that freedom that you have. And it was all, everybody did the same thing that we were doing. So we dated for a while and enjoyed ourselves. My drinking was, I'm drinking a lot, but so is he. I'm drinking a lot, and so are they. You hang around the people that drink the way you drink, you know, so you don't feel weird. And we were having a wonderful time, and then after about 6 months, I got the rids, and I got restless, irritable, discontented. Something's got to happen in my life. So I go to Gulf Shores for the weekend, and I have these applications to be a flight attendant on the dash of my car. I figured I love people. I'm German, so I speak German, which is not true. I love to travel, and if I go to flight attendant school, they'll teach me how to pack. So I have these applications to be a flight attendant on the dash of my car, and when I get to Gulf Shores, he says, well, what is this? And I said, well, I'm going to be a flight attendant. And it was before relationship was the big word, and he said, well, what about us? And I go, well, what about us? And he started stuttering a little bit, and he said, well, aren't we? And he couldn't finish, and with all the earnestness at my command, I said, oh, do you want to get married? And he said, yes. So remember alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Remember Utah, cunning, baffling, powerful. We got married and we started our journey in a relationship together in Gulf Shores, and what a joy, what an absolute joy. We were married for 16 and a half years, and in the beginning we partied hard. When you live in a tourist town, and we worked hard, that's just what we did. And our drinking, it was interesting. I thought he had a problem because he did some really strange things when we were out together, and he doesn't though. And I realized that it was interesting when I reflect back. For example, we would drink the same amount. And he would say, Utah, I think I've had too much to drink. Would you drive? Now, I had as much to drink as he did, if not more. And it's not what alcohol did to me, it's what alcohol does for me. Because when I have a lot to drink, oh yes, I can drive. I can drive real good. It was my perception that I could drive. So those were little hints that maybe something isn't right. We continued to drink and enjoy our lives together and party. And in 1978, we had our first child. Her name is Andrea. And she's 26 now, and I just got to throw this in real quick, and she's oh my gosh, she's going to get married in November, and this is like so cool, you know, just so cool. But we had Andrea, and God in his infinite wisdom and grace, when I was pregnant, for some reason, alcohol was the only thing that made me sick. I did not know that you shouldn't drink. As a matter of fact, when they said, Utah, the test is positive, and I said, positive I am or positive I'm not. You know, I mean, I just didn't know. And I did not drink because the booze made me sick. So thank God, because I didn't know I shouldn't be drinking while you're pregnant. So we had Andrea in 1978. In 1979, a year later, we survived Hurricane Frederick. We lost everything we owned. And it was kind of interesting, but I was used to starting over. It was not a big deal. There was nothing left of our home or anything, and we just started over. In 1980, we started our own real estate company, and it was interesting. My husband did real estate sales, and I did property management, and I love property management because, you know, you only have to make people happy for like a week or 2 weeks, you know, and that was, so I loved property management. That was my heyday. I'll tell you that today that this real estate company is doing fine without me. I was able to participate in that and be a part of that growth for 10 years until things just, alcoholism caught up with me. In 1981, we had our second daughter. Her name is Erin. Andrea, the first daughter, I describe her as the wind beneath my wings. And Erin, our second daughter, is my sunshine. I mean, she just, when she walks into a room, she lights up the room. And once again, I didn't drink. And I blame Erin for, after I had her, I blame Erin, and she will tell you this, for my morning drinking. We lived on an island at the time, Ono Island, and I wanted to get rid of baby fat, so I started jogging. And I'm not athletic, but I was just kind of like jogging around, you know, do whatever you do. And I had worked myself up to 6.2 miles, which is a 10K. And I ran in my first 10K in Pensacola, Florida, Fiesta Five Flags, and it was wonderful. I mean, in Bill's story where it says he had arrived, I had arrived. It was the first time that I felt I had done anything worthwhile, you know, that I could take credit for. I ran in my first 10K in Pensacola, and it was so interesting. They were applauding, you know, when you come through the finish line and cheering you on. And when I got through, they had all the Coke and all the Gatorade you could drink here, and they had all the beer you could drink here. I don't drink Coke, and I don't drink Gatorade, but I drink beer. So that morning, I drank beer at 9 o'clock, and I go, yay. I mean, that's all it took was just a yay. I ran every day after that, and I don't care if it was 6 miles, 8 miles, or 10 miles, I deserve to drink. And so that started my morning drinking. I would show up for work, do what I needed to do, make everybody happy. And then after a few years of this, the girls got a little older, and they were going to preschool and kindergarten and grammar school. And, you know, after you work all day and you have to kick in your second shift and doing homework with the girls and bathing them and cooking supper and doing all this. And all I wanted was something just to get the edge off, just that edge. I don't know if you know what that edge is, but it was there. And so I started, and it was because of this chef, but I started drinking wine while I was cooking, because he was on TV and he was drinking wine and he was cooking with wine. And I went, well, I can do this. So we cooked with the wine and we drank the wine and we cooked with the wine and I am having wonderful time with this chef. He recently died, and I met his niece. It was funny, in a function like this. She said, that was my uncle. And what happened, though, I was drinking, so I was starting to have blackouts. So I had no idea what I was cooking, how I was cooking, the girls, how they got bathed. I mean, I'm in a blackout, and I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm acting a little strange, and my husband commented, he said, Utah, don't you think you're drinking too much? Now, this was before I knew about inventory, but I took an inventory then. And I said, well, he thinks I'm drinking too much, and I haven't had enough. So how can I be drinking too much? Now, don't say anything negative to me, because I take it personal. And I took that very personal when he thought I was drinking too much, and I could not stop drinking. So what I had to do was hide the booze. And these big, huge green bottles, you know, when they fit in this gumbo pot. I would do Cajun cooking, but it wouldn't be gumbo every night. So I would put the wine in this big bottle of wine in this gumbo pot, and I'd have glasses stashed all over the house, and so he wouldn't know. And someone, a good friend, said, Utah, did you know that you can't smell vodka? Oh, no. I did not know that. So there's no more big green bottles, and out comes the gallons of vodka that fit in the tank of the toilet, that fit in the clothes hamper, and I had glasses of vodka all over the house, because I'm at this point, I am pretty much drinking around the clock. How I function, I don't know. A lot of times it was in blackouts. I had to especially drink a lot before church. And this is interesting. This is a chapel. But we would faithfully go to church, and I would kneel when they kneeled, and I would pray when they prayed, and I had the prayers. They were written out on these little pieces of paper, so I didn't have to make up anything. And I would participate in that service. And looking around at y'all, I would look at you and I'm going, why am I not getting it? I'm looking at the stained glass. I'm looking at the crucifix, and there's something missing, that God-shaped hole in my soul. And why do you have it? I'm doing everything that you're doing. So I had to drink a lot before I went to church so I wouldn't feel bad. And this particular Sunday, I drank quite a bit, and I go into a blackout. And we go to church, come home, I cook lunch, we do the lunch thing, and then we go bike riding as a family. And I could not balance a bicycle. And the bike crashed, and my husband, my gosh, he was scared to death. Oh my God. He thought I had a brain tumor that, you know, just went nuts. And he thought perhaps my sinuses had exploded. Because what I used to do was I would buy over-the-counter sinus medication that the box said may cause drowsiness, do not operate heavy equipment, because when he thought I was acting weird, I would tell him my sinuses were bothering me and I had to take this sinus medication. So he thought my sinuses exploded. And when I crashed that bicycle, what was interesting was I came out of that blackout immediately, poof, like that. I mean, I'm like there. And he said, we have got to go to the hospital, to the doctor, whatever. I said, no, it's Sunday. Don't worry. I'll be okay. We'll go tomorrow. We go home, and I didn't drink anything after that. Now, that next day, we go to Pensacola to the doctor, and I'm shaking. I'm doing some kind of shaking. I can't fill out any forms, and they x-ray my head, and they realize that I don't have a brain tumor, and my sinuses were fine. So the doctor talks to me, and you know, my physical condition isn't that good. And he said, "Utah, how much do you drink?" And I went, "Well, you know, I have two every now and then." He didn't know it was two progressive drinks, you know. And he said, "Well, you may have a problem. You may be having a nervous breakdown." And I went, "That's it. That is it. If you had to control the universe like I did, if you had to make sure there were no jellyfish in the Gulf of Mexico and the sun was shining and there was no seaweed on the beach, if you had to do that, you would be having a nervous breakdown too." And then he said, "Or you may have a problem with alcohol." And I go, "What do you think it is?" And he said, "Well, I'm not sure, but I would like to suggest you go into treatment." And he put me in treatment, and he said, "I want you to go to the alcoholic floor first. And if you don't fit in there, I will move you to the other floor where they're having nervous breakdowns." Now, I am a people pleaser. So I go on the alcoholic floor, and they had the alcoholics and the drug addicts and the overeaters and the whatever. We were all mixed together at this hospital. So I go in there, and I just stay right there. I do what I'm asked to do, and, you know, I act as if. You know, I just act as if. After 21 days of treatment, I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. But my mind said, you know, it's got to be something else. How can one drink for 22 years and poof, be an alcoholic? How can that happen? So I got out of treatment, and I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went with a lot of guilt. And the guilt was, how could my family do without me for an hour? You know, how could they do without me? And so I'd get there right on time, and I'd leave right on time, and that was just it. Nothing changed in my life except for the fact that I'm not drinking and I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the only thing that had changed. I saw you in those meetings, and you were talking about this big book. And I looked all over the room, and I did not see anything that said big book. And I'm not going to ask you what the big book is, because if I ask you, you're going to know I don't know. And I'm supposed to know everything. So I did nothing. After 6 months of going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and not drinking, my husband decided that he loved someone else. And I had no foundation in recovery, no foundation in spirituality, no foundation whatsoever. He rocked my world. And what happened whenever I learned this, it was brought to my attention, I can't go to work anymore. How can I go to work, even though it's my business? How can I go there because they're going to know that he loves someone else? And so I got a part-time job, and that part-time job was delivering flowers, and I was delivering flowers up and down the beach 3 months later. I had just picked up a 9-month sobriety chip or medallion, and my husband and I were separated at the time, and I had my daughters with me. I'd picked up my 9-month medallion, and it was Valentine's Day, and I'm delivering flowers up and down the beach, and there's a warning sign that I'd heard in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was HALT, H-A-L-T, Relonely Tired. And when I got home that evening, I was very hungry because I hadn't had time to get something to eat. And I was very angry because no one loved me. I was lonely because my separated husband picked up our two daughters and took them out to dinner. And I was very tired just from the physical work it took. And I sat there in my living room and I said, if this is what it is to be sober, I don't want it. I do not want it. I got up, I went to the liquor store and I bought something clear and I fixed a drink. And nothing happened. I fixed a second drink and the magic of the booze happened for me again. I didn't have to think. I didn't have to feel. I didn't have to be. I didn't have to do. All I had to do was just be. I could just be there. And that was that peace and that serenity that I had been looking for, that God-shaped hole in my soul was filled by spirits, and booze is called spirits, so it filled that hole again for me. And those two drinks brought me to, they lasted a year. I started drinking around the clock right after that. And my husband and I we got a divorce, and I am starting to go, and I'm not proud of this, but it's part of my story. I start going to the bars by myself. I am single for the first time in 16 and a half years, and I go to the bars by myself, and for some reason, I'm having a lot of blackouts, and that doesn't justify my actions, but it was just what happened to me. And I bring home men every night. When I go to those bars, I leave phone numbers of bars, local bars in Gulf Shores, for my daughters because they're 7 and 10. And if they need me, this is where they can probably find me if they need me. And I justified that because when we were married, we would leave the numbers of wherever we were, not the bars, but other places, functions, where they could get in touch with us. I get a DUI and reckless driving, and I go to jail. And my husband and I do get a divorce, and I lose all rights to the business that we started. I lose the home under construction. Going to jail was not enough to stop me from drinking. I remembered when I showed up for court for that DUI and reckless driving. You know, I'm there drunk. I am drunk. I tell the DA, who was a friend of mine, he said, Utah, why are you here? And I remember I told him, read it and weep. You know, I mean, how smug and arrogant I was at that time. I stand in a courtroom, and I vaguely remember this, but I stand in a courtroom and I listen to a judge talking about me, and I see some people that I know that I thought were friends, and they were testifying against me, and I lost all the rights and the custody to my two daughters. And I found out later that I had brought home someone one night in a blackout that took away their innocence. I have permission to share that with you for my daughters. They have given me permission to share that. And they said, Mom, if you can help someone, then please share that. My two daughters have taught me the unbelievable principle of forgiveness. They really have. None of this stopped me from drinking. My ultimate bottom was alcoholic hepatitis. My esophagus was hemorrhaging. I couldn't get anything down. I'm going through DTs and convulsions and my heart's coming out of my chest. And if you've been through DTs, you know what it's like, and your legs cramp and there's blood all over the place and my body's shutting down. And I'm found and immediately ambulanced to the emergency in Pensacola. And what happened is, because I couldn't get any booze down, I don't know how long it took, but I wasn't drunk. You know, I'm not drunk because nothing would go down, but I'm very, very sick. And in the ambulance, and they're shouting at me, trying to keep me coherent, and my last thought was, if I could get a little vodka down, I'd be okay. Because see, the booze had worked for such a long time. I don't know how long I was in the hospital. My body was shutting down. The next thing I know is I am literally poofed in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm at the Gulf Shores Jubilee that's held the end of February every year. And I am sitting there, and the old timers in Gulf Shores will tell you that I was sitting there in that state of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, and I was dripping. I could not walk, I could not talk, but I was there in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time in my life, I could be honest with myself, and I could be honest with you, and I realized I was powerless. I am powerless over alcohol. And I had a problem with my life becoming unmanageable because I had no life. There was nothing left. I shared this at the meeting last night. Today, where I am, the book says, for us to drink is to die. I don't fear death today. What I fear is for me to drink again and not die. And if you've been through that hell, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Because I couldn't even die right, and I know I tried. My life had become unmanageable. I didn't know anything about that because there was no life left. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Well, I had to come to believe that there was something that you were talking about, and this was God, G-O-D. God, in that first step for me, was gift of desperation. You know, I had nothing to lose. I had nothing left, and that became my God. And in that second step, I wasn't desperate anymore. So I needed another God, and what God became was you, group of drunks. You gave me the hope that I could be restored to sanity with your honesty, with your open-mindedness, with your patience, and your enthusiasm. And enthusiasm comes from the Greek, and it means God within. You gave me the hope. And I looked at that third step, and you know, how do I do this? How do I make a decision to turn my will and my life over the care of God? You could not be my God anymore. Because my beautiful God, G-O-D, group of drunks, some of you went back out and drank again. And you came in and told me what it was like. Some of you went back out and you didn't make it back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I kneeled at your casket. And I wondered, why are you there and I'm here? So you could not be my God. God became in that third step. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over the care of G-O-D, good orderly direction. Now, we talked about this last night at a meeting. I believe in sponsorship. And I knew I needed a sponsor. At this particular time in where I was, no one would sponsor me because they thought I was going to die. So I made a decision to turn my will and my life over the care of good orderly direction. And the good orderly direction, or God, became the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what was interesting about that, I turned the page and I said the prayer, and this taught me how to pray, the third step prayer. And then it said, next we launch on a course of vigorous action. And I read that I had to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And I go, and I looked at all those pages, and I looked at those, the writing, and I had no idea what it meant. So I knew I needed some guidance with this inventory because I couldn't do it on my own. And what I did, I asked a friend of mine in the program that I'd known and I'd respected and honored, and it was a man, and I said, Jerry, I said, I need help with this inventory, and I'm ready to do it, but I don't understand it in the book. And Jerry said, Utah, I prayed this morning. Who could I help in Alcoholics Anonymous? And you must be an answer to my prayer. So Jerry laid out the four step for me, and I found out that I could four column out my resentments. I could do my fear inventory and my sex conduct inventory, and do this with a courage because of the prayers that I said. Again, I had nothing to lose by doing this inventory, nothing. I found out that that beautiful husband that I loved and admired and respected and conned and manipulated, that I resented him because he left me. And because of that inventory, I found out when he left me, he affected every aspect of my life. My self-esteem, my pocketbook, my sex relationships, my personal relationships, my ambitions, my security. He affected every aspect of my life by leaving me. And then when Jerry said, well, what we're going to do now, we're going to disregard he's involved entirely, and I want you to do this fourth column. Now, I've heard in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that when they refer to the fourth column, they refer to it as looking at their part. Well, this alcoholic mind puts a peculiar twist on my part, because if I have a part, that means you still have a part. So Jerry said, no, we're going to look at you, no part, we're just going to look at you. And I found out throughout our whole marriage I was selfish. I was self-seeking, and I was dishonest, and I was frightened, and I was inconsiderate. And I found out that because of that, because of the way I am, that he did not leave me, that I drove him away. The freedom of that was the fact that he didn't have to do anything for me to get better. He didn't have to come back. He didn't have to give me any money. He didn't have to give me the business back. He didn't have to do anything for me to continue with these steps. And so I did that fifth step with Jerry, and I experienced the wonderful principle of character. And character is who you are when no one but God is watching. And I experienced that. I experienced a freedom and a happiness when I was able to be honest with Jerry. And he moved me then to the sixth step, and I was entirely ready to have God remove my defects of character. Now, I did have to pray for a few of them, because the willingness to be willing, because some of them kind of still worked. You know, when you wear the mask and do the dance and play the part for so long, some of that still works. You know, and I had to pray for the willingness to be willing and then humbly ask God to remove them. In that seventh step, and I love this because, see, I learned how to pray in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned the third step prayer. And then I learned the seventh step prayer. And the gift of that was, after the seventh step prayer, there was amen. There's no amen after the third step prayer. So it's a continuous prayer. Those steps are for me. And when I experienced humility for the first time in my life, not thinking less of myself, but thinking of myself less, getting out of me, what can I do for you? I was brought to the eighth step, which I had to make a list of all the people I'd harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And I was challenged with that, because some of these people that were on my list had harmed me or harmed my daughters. I had brought someone home one night in a blackout that robbed me, you know, and he was on my list. So how do I get to the other side of that? And the way I got to the other side of that, there's a greeting in India, the country India, East India, and they put their hands together and they bow and say, Namaste. Translated, the God in me recognizes and honors the God in you. And I prayed to see the God in everyone on that list. And I became ready to make amends. And I made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. The man that robbed me and the one that took away my daughter's innocence, I've been asked several times to speak at an all-male maximum security prison. And when I go there, I look in the room of about 200 men and I look at them and I said, do you know me? Because if that man is in that room who knows me, I owe that man amends. Because I started the ball rolling. I experienced forgiveness in that ninth step. Forgiveness is the fragrance that the blossom leaves on the soul after it has crushed the flower. And that was written by Margaret Fishback Powers, who wrote Footprints. And I could see myself walking in a meadow, and I cannot help but step on these beautiful flowers. And what does the flower give me but the fragrance on the bottom of my soul? Continue to take personal inventory. I don't like this one, because it says every time I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with me. And that just, I don't like that. What do you mean there's something wrong with me? And then I was told, well, it doesn't mean you're wrong. It means there's something wrong with you. Now, after 6 months of sobriety and I had gotten to the ninth step and made amends, I moved to Auburn, Alabama. Not my plan. The gift of that was that 10th step was there, and I continued to take personal inventory. And I was able to, at my home group, I joined a home group, and it was Rule 62 group. Don't take yourself too damn seriously, you know? And so it was just a wonderful gift to move to this little home group, and I loved it. And it forced me to go to meetings outside of my home group, because Auburn, even though it's a college town, it's small, and you had to go to meetings all over, and I was able to go all over in Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama, and I loved it. And I got a job at Auburn University, and I was able to work in the study abroad office, sending Auburn students all over the world to study. And it was kind of a groundbreaking for me in sponsorship. Because in sponsorship, when you sponsor someone, you know, you have someone that asks you to help them and walk with them to take the steps. Well, I'd have these students that come into the office and they go, Utah, we want to do something different with our lives and we're afraid. And would you help us? And all I had to do was help them take the steps so they could study in another country. And when they came back, they would be on fire with life. You know, just on fire with life. I got active in my home group, and I was got into the general service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous in my home group. I became, after a few years, the GSR, and it was a wonderful experience. And I was introduced to area assembly, and I was introduced to to the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked at that 11th step and we were, oh Lord. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And I prayed so many times, God, what is your will for me? And I'm pounding on the table. I have my RPMs in the morning, reading, prayer, and meditation. I'm pounding, you know, what's the point in all of this? Because I'm not feeling your presence. And God did this little thump on my head and said, the point is you're willing to grow along spiritual lines. Now that held me for a little while, but then all of a sudden, okay, God, I want the tablets, I want the burning bush, I want to know what is it you want me to do? Because here I am being and doing, and I'm not guided. And God said, Utah, I want you to be an instrument of my peace. Where there's hatred, may I sow love. Where there's injury, may I bring pardon. Doubt, faith, despair, hope. Darkness, light, sadness, joy. And that 11th step prayer goes on to say, O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love, for it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. And it is in dying to my ego self that we are born to eternal life. And this launched me into a journey of experiencing a loving God in our second tradition, as He expressed Himself in our group conscience. Have you ever been to a business meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous? If you haven't met the loving God, keep coming back. It'll happen. It'll happen. And I experienced that loving God in service of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to that 12th step. And it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. And what I experienced was, the message is, I've had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. It's not about me. It is about Alcoholics Anonymous and how can I help you? How may I help you? How may I best serve you? And God said, Utah, if you show up, I'll do the rest. God has asked me to do many, many things in Alcoholics Anonymous, this being one. And I go, I don't do this. I don't do this, what I'm doing. I don't go to my home group and make coffee. I don't talk to newcomers. I don't greet people. That is not what I do. But the God of my understanding has guided me and given me the strength and the courage to just show up. And I've experienced a joy beyond my wildest dreams. Because of service and the loving God who has asked me to show up at things, I have had the privilege and the honor of serving Area 1, Alabama, Northwest Florida, as a delegate, you know, and they just had the conference, and my heart was there. You meet, like here, you meet people all over the world that love Alcoholics Anonymous, that love the singleness of purpose, and have a God of their understanding, and knowing that we have got to help others if we're going to stay whole and so survive. You know, we have got to do this. Also, in my journey in service, a little over 4 years ago, I met my current husband. His name is Charles, and you'll hear him tomorrow night. Now, Charles was not my vision for me, but Charles was God's vision for me, and said, Utah, the primary fact you fail to recognize is your total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. So I'm going to give you an opportunity to learn a lesson. So God puts Charles in my life, and we get married, and I move from Auburn, and I move to Huntsville, and I get to experience these beautiful angels in Alcoholics Anonymous in Huntsville. Johanna's one of them, and Renee, and oh my gosh, it's my heart. It just wants to explode sometimes. I have a relationship with my daughters today that is, when my oldest daughter called and said, Mom, I'm getting married, and you're the first one I've called because you're my best friend. And my youngest daughter that'll call and says, Mom, I'm going to say all this stuff, but please know I'm just venting. You don't have to fix me. You don't have to do anything. I'm just venting. She trusts me. You know, she trusts me. And it's a joyful, joyful journey. I have a relationship with my brothers today. I have a relationship even with my first husband today that just blows me away, and his wife and their daughter. My mom is 76, and she has Parkinson's disease, and she lives in Pearl, Mississippi with my youngest brother. And it's his assignment. He wants her to be with him. My stepdad died 30 years ago with a heart attack at 42, but I've made amends to everyone that's on my list that I have an awareness of. I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life was service. I served and understood that service was joy. Joy being the most infallible sign of the presence of God. You bring me joy. I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. I sought my fellow man and found all three. And I want to thank you for being here for me. Thank you.